Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 20 years ago, next month, March 18, 1990, in the middle of a rainy night, thieves made off with 13 works of art from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Works of Rembrandt, Degas, Vermeer. A $500 million heist, the biggest in history. Art theft is the stuff of movies and thrillers. It's also very real. $6 billion worth a year, says the FBI. Where does it go? Where did these paintings go? This hour On Point, we'll ask about art theft and the biggest heist in history. You can join the conversation. What happens when art goes underground? What's it cost? Who gains? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston is a treasure. It is beautiful. It looks like a Venetian palazzo built by an heiress a century or so ago. Very grand. I was there yesterday with a tape recorder in tow and talked with the director of the museum, Ann Hawley, and with the director of security for the museum, Anthony Amore. Let's go to the tape for a second. We're standing in the room where thieves had a heyday, stealing priceless or nearly priceless Vermeers, Rembrandts. We were looking at next to a row of lovely windows, tall arched windows in the Dutch room, the desk and kind of easel where the Vermeer, the most expensive, the most valuable of all the paintings that were stolen, hung. This was a painting called The Concert. Museum director Ann Hawley described the painting as we stood right in front of the empty frame.
A woman sits at a harpsichord, and she has a very beautiful yellow-colored satin blouse on, and she's deeply concentrating on her playing the music. So she's in her own inner world, and then across the harpsichord from her is a woman who is looking out at you, and she has one hand raised. Her voice is about to give birth to song, and then there is a gentleman who is at a V between these two women with his back to us, sitting in a chair, his long hair, and he's playing the lute. And these three people are engaged in music making that is so profound that you, when you look at it, you almost feel like you're intruding.
Gardner Museum director Ann Hawley in the museum just yesterday in a very grand room describing a painting that has not hung in that frame for 20 years, stolen, maybe a $300 million painting of Vermeer, the most valuable of all those taken, but many taken on that night, Rembrandt, Degas. I strolled through that room. I strolled to the blue room with the head of security for the Gardner Museum, Anthony Amore, and I asked him why, throughout the museum, the Gardner has left empty frames where the stolen pictures had once hung.
The museum's left them on the wall because we view them as placeholders. Each one of these frames held a really important piece to this major collective work of art that Mrs. Gardner created. And we really do feel that any piece that's removed from it, it takes away from her collective work.
Placeholders in an absolutely lovely museum. We strolled the grounds. We went to the basement where the security guards, two of them, on that night, March 18th, 1990, had been taken by the thieves, handcuffed, bound in duct tape. Anthony Amore talked about what we know, what we might learn from the conversations the guards had, or the thieves had with the guards.
He was very polite to him and kind in some respects. He apologized to him a number of times.
What does that tell you?
Perhaps he was new to the game. He wasn't an experienced criminal. He said over and over, "We're sorry, we have to do this to you." Uh-huh. Maybe he even worked in the same type of field. Mm-hmm. He might have felt some type of affinity or kinship with
like maybe a rookie.
Probably a rookie. He was a younger guy. He didn't speak much until he started apologizing. In fact, when he handcuffed this person at first, he asked him if the cuffs were too tight. The guard said yes, and he redid them.
Wow.
Which is amazing. And he kept saying, "Get comfortable, you're going to be here all night. We're sorry, we're not going to hurt you. Just keep your mouth shut."
Just keep your mouth shut. And there we stood in the basement of the Gardner Museum next to the steam pipes and sink where 20 years ago the guards were handcuffed, duct tape, and left while The thieves spent 81 minutes taking 13 works of art, $500 million, half $1 billion worth of art from the Gardner Museum, the biggest heist in history. That was in the museum yesterday with me right now in the studio, and I'm very happy to have them both, are the museum director, Ann Hawley. She's been the director since 1989, the year before the famous theft. Ann Hawley, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And with us, Anthony Amore, director of security at the Gardner Museum since 2005. He is responsible for recovering the hall stolen two decades ago. It is his job and his obsession. Anthony Amore, welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And it's been 20 years.
Yes.
Priceless or nearly priceless paintings, $500,000 is a very big number, but it's the art itself that's lost to the museum and lost to the world. It hasn't been seen. What is the hole in the life of the museum, our culture, art lovers, that this theft left?
It stripped out very important works that the public has been unable to see now for 20 years. I always say it would be like having someone remove from our culture all of the works of Louis Armstrong or the poetry of Robert Frost or a play by Shakespeare. These works are part of a cultural communication, and to have wrenched them from the museum is to take them away from our culture and from meaning. They're really priceless, and whoever has them, and I know they're out there, I always say, please, please keep them safe in a good temperature, no more than 65 degrees Fahrenheit, and in a humidity of 50%, because they will be destroyed if they aren't taken care of.
You say that as though they're still out there, they're still extant, and we will see them again. What's your confidence level in that?
Well, I just feel very much that they're out there. It's an intuition. I also feel they're not very far away. And we know there are many, many people that come to us with information, and I just am always pleading whenever I'm speaking publicly for anyone that has information to contact Anthony Amore, our director of security, because we can guarantee confidentiality, and we do have a $5 million reward out for the safe return of all of the art.
We heard your description of the Vermeer, the concert. Give us a real quick tour. There's 13 works of art in all, Rembrandt, Degas. Describe a few of the most notable of these. If we were looking at them, just quickly, what would we see?
In addition to the Vermeer, which you heard a brief
concert
description of, Rembrandt painted his only seascape in 1633. It's a very old work, and it shows the disciples and Christ in a ship that is churning on a very high sea.
The storm on the Sea of Galilee.
That's right. The storm on the Sea of Galilee.
The wind is whipping. It's got the famous light and dark of Rembrandt.
That's
very
right.
Obvious.
Yes.
And he's painted himself into this painting.
Correct.
One of the disciples staring out at it.
He's made himself one of the disciples, a device that many artists used in their works during the Renaissance. The other work from that room that was by Rembrandt is a portrait of a lady and gentleman in black. Two very stern-looking Dutch people, a couple who are staring out of you from the frame, dressed in black with very large white ruffled collars. Mm.
There's a famous Manet, the Chez Tortini.
Yes, and there is this fabulous Chez Tortini by Manet, which is a man in a top hat looking very dapper, sitting in a cafe in Paris, enjoying life to the fullest and with wonderful brushstrokes that Manet could convey that joy with.
And Degas. Several of them, and not ballet dancers here, but horses and
There's,
jockeys from
yes,
the track.
Some wonderful works on paper, small works by Degas, a wonderful rendering of horses with jockeys riding them, drawings of horses, and sort of works for study, works for himself. The Degas are very sophisticated works, and was quite surprising that those were taken.
And they're gone. They're taken. And Anthony Amore, do you share this gut feeling that the paintings will ever be found? It's such a big underground out there. I don't know. Who knows if these paintings have gone off to a professional kind of art, stolen art underground, or they're just in somebody's basement. Do you think we'll see them again?
I personally have no doubt. I'm absolutely confident that we will recover the stolen art. And I believe that it'll be back on the walls where it belongs.
20 years. If we're going to recover it, why not already? 20 years is a long time.
Indeed. Often stolen art goes away for a long time. I would say that today we have an effort underway to recover this art that is unprecedented. We have an amazing amount of cooperation between the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the museum. And we work very closely together, and I'm so confident because I think all the pieces are in place. I think there's nothing we are not doing that we should be doing in order to recover this art.
So why hasn't a $5 million reward brought something forward here?
I think there are a variety of reasons. Perhaps the history of crime in Boston, and perhaps the old guard at the FBI. I mean, we all know the stories that have been sensationalized in the press about John Connolly and Whitey Bulger and this old lore from Boston.
This is sort of Whitey Bulger, the on-the-lam brother of a very prominent Massachusetts politician, and the kind of old Irish American mob world.
Exactly.
Even there, $5 million is a lot of money.
True. And this is just one mm-hmm. possibility that maybe people didn't feel a great amount of confidence in years past to come forward with information. But mm-hmm. One of the messages I like to bring is that this is a different FBI, it's a different U.S. Attorney's Office, and the museum is ready to pay the reward, and we're ready to recover our art.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biggest art theft in history, unsolved after 20 years, and what happens to the art that gets away. March 18th, 1990, the Gardner Museum in Boston, $500 million in artworks, Rembrandt, Degas, Vermeer, gone in the middle of the night. After 20 years of searching, they are still gone. The museum director, Ann Hawley, joins us this hour in the studio. Anthony Amore, head of security at the Gardner, also with us. We were there yesterday in the very rooms where the paintings had hung, where the empty frames hang today. We were in the basement along the steam pipes where the guards were handcuffed and duct taped up like mummies. Everybody loves to think about and talk about art heists. They're always in thrillers. They're in the movies. The 1999 heist film, The Thomas Crown Affair, with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo. Here's Rene Russo trying to piece together how that fictional heist happened.
They shut off the air to drive out the tourists. Then they close the gates to keep everybody out. Diversion. Make a lot of noise over there. So over here in this room, you can take $100 million off the wall and waltz right out the front door. That's good.
That's the movie version, but it is very, very real. As the Gardner knows, so do many other museums around the world. In February 2008, four paintings by Cézanne, Van Gogh, Degas, Monet, worth more than $160 million, were stolen from a museum in Zurich in one of the biggest art heists in European history. Since then, two of the paintings have been recovered. Here's a report from the Associated Press.
Three masked men entered the museum a half hour before closing. One used a pistol to force employees to the floor, while the other two robbers went to collect the paintings. This police spokesman says the robbers acted in a professional way, with the whole heist lasting 3 minutes. They left in a van, possibly with some of the art sticking out the back.
A Zurich heist, very professional, 3 minutes in and out. Very different from the Gardner. It was 81 minutes. We've got the head of Gardner Security sitting here with us today, as well as Ann Hawley, the director of the studio, and lots of callers. Martha in Montpelier, Vermont. Martha, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if they can get any information about the people who took the art by the combination of art that was taken.
The choices in what they took. Anthony Amore, is there a message in what was taken and what was not taken from the museum?
Well, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were from what we can tell from the motion detection information that we still have,
which would have tracked where they were in the building.
Exactly. It appears that one of the thieves, basically, for most of the time that paintings were being stolen, one of the thieves was in the Dutch room taking the Rembrandts and the Vermeer. And the other thief was in the short gallery taking five Degas, attempting to take a Napoleonic flag, mm-hmm. and ultimately taking a Napoleonic finial.
That's just a sort of golden eagle from the top of the flagpole.
Exactly. It was from Napoleon's 1st Regiment. Mm-hmm. It matched the flagpole. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the way the two different thieves worked, possibly one theory, again, is that the thief who was in the Dutch room had more of an agenda to take high-priced...
newest stuff.
Valuable piece.
Mm-hmm.
Valuable pieces. And the other appears to have been acting on his own and just taking perhaps what appealed to him personally. The Degas, as you mentioned, have jockeys on horses.
Maybe he'd been at the track recently. And Holly, but you reminded me just yesterday, standing in the Dutch room, there was a Rubens right in between the Rembrandts.
Yes.
That are gone, untouched, untaken.
Right. I also think that what puzzles me is I think that Anthony does have a point about horses and jockeys, but Degas is, these were sort of sketches. They weren't real finished work. And Degas was sort of a very cerebral artist, mm-hmm. and the work was not really as accessible in a way. And so I've often puzzled that, you know, why that work? And was it someone who really loved that work and knew about it? Because it just seems like such a strange choice.
They were very effective getting in. Now, it has to be said, in retrospect, the museum's security on that night is seen as fairly lacking. They came to the door dressed as Boston policemen. They were allowed in, and it was a very quick work to have those two guards in cuffs and in the basement and out of their way. They sort of lounged through 80 minutes, not 3 minutes, like the Zurich theft. Let's get another question. John in Needham, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Just quickly, was the art cut? Did they do it professionally? Can you sort of elaborate on whether they took care in what they were doing, and how does that impact the investigation? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, John. It's a great question. Anthony, you were describing to me yesterday, again, in the Dutch room of this beautiful museum, how pretty rough with these paintings the thieves were, these nearly priceless paintings.
Right. Well, there's a two-part answer to that. First, I'd say in terms of doing it professionally, I would say that if you research art theft, especially here in the United States, the term professional, when referring to an art thief, is kind of a fallacy. There aren't really the art thieves like you would see in the Thomas Crown Affair or other Hollywood productions. I would say, though, in terms of what was cut, it was the two large Rembrandts, Storm in the Sea of Galilee and Portrait of a Lady and Gentleman in Black, that were cut. The rest were not cut.
Cut meaning what? They simply cut around the edge of the frame to remove them?
Right. They took the large frames off of the wall, dropped mm-hmm. the frames to the floor.
Dropped them. They're shattered.
Right. They didn't shatter, but
okay.
they were rough with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then took a very sharp instrument, we can mm-hmm. tell by the grooves left in the stretchers,
mm-hmm.
and cut along the inside of the frame.
So the edge of the canvas would have been left actually in the frame.
Behind the frame,
behind,
right.
Yes.
Then it was, most people picture these jagged edges. The,
mm-hmm.
the paintings were cut pretty clean.
Mm-hmm. Is that professional or is that absolutely unprofessional?
It's neither, is the point I'm trying to make, that mm-hmm. These people who steal art, again, especially here in Massachusetts, are thieves who also rob banks and drugstores and do home invasions, that type of thing.
You think these were local thieves? They didn't fly in from Zurich to do the job?
My instinct, actually, I'm convinced they're local. I've spoken at length to at least one of the guards who noticed no discernible accent. One time it was mentioned that...
In other words, it sounded like a local accent.
It sounded like a local.
Was, mm-hmm.
The word mate was used,
mm-hmm.
apparently, or
mm-hmm.
possibly,
mm-hmm.
but... That's kind of thrown people off the track for a while. I think people think that means it was a foreign person. The accents were local.
Local, does that say to you professional or not professional?
Professional in terms of criminal,
mm-hmm.
but not in terms
art
of...
Art thief?
I don't really subscribe to the belief of a professional art thief.
This wasn't a Pierce Brosnan-style Thomas Crown super slick...
In the United States, I don't think there is a case of a super slick Thomas Crown-type art theft.
So I wonder where that leaves us. Here's from Facebook. We've got a message from Barbara. She says, how much I would love to go and just sit in front of the Vermeer. And you and I did that
just
in front of the place. It would have been. Only a word
in
picture.
In our imagination.
Yes. She says, but then Barbara writes, but only one person can, and I suspect they love it less for the artistic value than the fact that they have something in their possession that they could not have by legal means. Or maybe even worse, they never look at it, just having it stored away and feeling oh so clever. Sigh, writes Barbara. Aunt Holly, Where do you picture these paintings being now? Is it some, you know, we have all these images of some, I don't know, billionaire sitting somewhere around the world in his private underground gallery.
I don't
gallery.
Think that at all. I think they're in a box or a case stored away. I don't think that the Vermeer is being lovingly studied.
In the hands of a connoisseur?
No. No, I think that it's in the hands. I actually don't think it's in the hands of criminals. I think it's in the hands of someone to whom they were passed for keeping. Whomever that is, I don't know.
All right, let's think about motive then, Anthony. I mean, if it's not in the hands of an art lover, why did this theft occur in the first place? What have been the various motives considered in the various potential suspects over the years?
Massachusetts has a very infamous history in terms of art theft, and precedents were set here in Massachusetts in terms of stealing valuable art and using it to get out of jail free or to use it to barter for some other type of illicit activity, maybe drugs or the rest. It's very, very almost unprecedented for it to be hanging on the wall somewhere, or it's stolen as like collateral. For some other means.
As we walked through the museum just yesterday, you pointed out a number of hints that this might have been an inside job.
There are a lot of clues that lead an investigator to think that there was definitely, and at least in my opinion, definitely inside information. There was a hidden door in the Dutch room.
Behind one of the Rembrandts.
Exactly.
That you can't see in that damask unless you know it's there or know it was there. I guess it's been sealed now.
Just very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I when I walked through with you, you didn't notice at first.
No,
okay,
but it was open that night.
It was found open the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
And studied the pictures of it for hours with experts who can tell that it was open from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
That type of detail. We've mm-hmm. looked into it. The 81 minutes that people spent in the museum is a very unusual level of comfort. It talks to the thieves knowing aspects of our security procedures.
There was no, what do you call it, a dead man?
A dead man switch.
That is a switch that the guards would have needed to hit every so often, whatever, 10, 20 minutes.
Exactly.
And if they didn't, it would alert police or somebody else. No such switch. They seem to know that.
They seem to know.
They
and
weren't
that's,
worried.
That's a very common type of instrument that a security operation would use. And for them to not be worried about that, to spend almost an hour and a half in a museum. As you said, that's 30 times longer than they spent in Zurich. And to take 13 pieces of art, it's almost marked by what was left behind in some respects.
Who do you think ordered up this theft? You know, Ulrich Boser did a big book, The Gardner Heist. He concludes that it's a guy named David Turner, a kind of Boston mobster who's now in prison on a long sentence. Do you agree? If not that, where, who, why, what?
There are a number of theories out there, and my real marching orders for myself, my internal mm-hmm. marching orders are that I can't rule out anybody until the paintings are on the wall. So I think Mr. Boser's theory is interesting. It's something that we were well aware of before before he started writing the book, mm-hmm. and it's interesting, but the paintings haven't been returned, so our work just continues.
Is the investigation active?
Incredibly active. Incredibly.
What does that mean?
That means that I myself spend far too many hours a day on it.
Do the leads have any warmth? Are you on all cold trails? Are you close?
No. We're definitely not on all cold trails. I feel that we're working on some very strong leads. And again, I have great access to the FBI. The case agent's name is Jeff
mm-hmm.
Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to him daily, at least once a day.
Do they still have resources put to this after 20 years? It's
yes,
a long time.
Yes, and Jeff is the case agent. He's been on it for almost 9 years now. And talk every day with him. And a relatively recent development in the last few years, I have the same level of access with a dedicated assistant U.S. attorney who deals with the Gardner case, an AUSA by the name of Brian Kelly. And being Boston, they're both Kellys. But
where do you picture these paintings being right now?
I actually agree with Anne. I think that I'm confident they're not on anybody's wall. Someone would have seen it.
You don't think it's a Dr. No, evil genius, having some exotic drink and muttering over them?
No. As a matter of fact, again, that's something that's unprecedented. You just don't find that. I'm glad you say Dr. No, because that's the genesis of this view people have. It was
mm-hmm.
from that James Bond film.
Mm-hmm.
There was a famous Goya painting that was stolen, and in the that same year, they wrote into the story, James Bond walks up Dr. No's steps as he's going to dinner with him, and he walks by the Goya, and he says, as a little aside, oh, that's where that went.
But there are stories of very valuable paintings being traded for arms, mm-hmm. traded for drugs. Maybe they're Anne in a Colombian drug lord.
Well, actually, a story that I can tell that follows that line of thinking is many years ago, probably 10 years ago, a teacher in Japan was taken to the home outside of Tokyo in, mm-hmm. in a suburban area to a businessman's very palatial home, which is something in Japan. Mm-hmm. And on the ceiling, he saw the Storm on the Sea of Galilee.
Installed in the ceiling.
And so...
This is one of the Rembrandts, one of the
big
ones that was...
Well, that's what he thought he saw, the Storm mm-hmm. on the Sea of Galilee. It was the Storm on the Sea of Galilee.
This is one of the missing paintings.
That's what he thought. He mm-hmm. contacted a friend who was a curator at the Cleveland Art Museum who mm-hmm. contacted me. We got right on it. It's very complicated. Mm-hmm. We had to work through the CIA, through the Japanese prefecture people. Many layers and layers. We finally got in with our conservator to look at it, and it was a copy.
Was it instantly apparent?
Yes. It was a copy done in Italy in the 1960s, and this businessman liked people to believe all of these works were real, but they were all copies. He had Gauguin, he had all kinds.
Even though this is known to be a stolen work of art, he was happy for people to believe that it was his.
Well, I don't think he knew it was stolen.
Oh, I see. And so the stories grow. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wish I had light to shed on who committed this awful crime, but I want to say the impact that it has. 35 years ago, I was a student at Harvard Medical School just up the street mm-hmm. from the Gardner Museum.
Yep.
And as often as once a week, I visited specifically the Vermeer and Storm on the Sea of Galilee. Those paintings offered me moments of beauty and serenity and really deep personal healing during a difficult educational experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this causes me enormous pain to know that someone stole them.
That's the power of this artwork. And the thought of them being empty frames today, Donna?
It leaves me feeling empty inside. It's so sad.
Donna, thank you very much. For your
Thank
call.
You.
It's amazing about, if you don't, what Donna said is that I'm, despite her pain, I'm envious of her because she's seen them and I've never seen them. And I spend, not to cry on anyone's shoulder here, but I spend.
You're the guy chasing them, the guy obsessed with finding them.
I think of them almost every waking moment and I've never seen them. So I'm really envious that she had that opportunity.
We're going to hear when we return from a long time. Head of the art investigations for the FBI, Robert Whitman. He's standing by right now in Washington. We'll get his view of the big picture of art theft in the world these days, and of this art theft in particular. We've got a lot of listeners calling in, standing by. Describe another one for us. Here's for example, a self-portrait. This is very small,
yes.
Just almost postage stamp size, but here's Rembrandt himself in a wonderful kind of saucy etching. He's wearing a hat that looks quite fashionable. I think it's a hat that looks fashionable right now.
It's like an artist's cap.
Yes, it does.
He loved to portray himself very early in his life when he was young as just a very sexy guy who was using all of his wiles and talents to represent himself because those pieces would be used to lure patrons, and he was very good at that.
He looks like a rock star right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the biggest art theft in history, unsolved after 20 years, and what happens to the art that gets away. March 1990, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, $500 million worth of artwork, 13 works right off the walls, right out of the museum. After 20 years of searching, they are still gone. The museum's director, Anne Hawley, is with us. In the studio today, Anthony Amore, head of security, is with us from the Gardner Museum as well. I was with them yesterday in the halls of this museum. It's a treasure, and the frames are still empty. We're going to hear in just a second from a longtime FBI head of investigations on this front, but let me share Here's an email posting, Anthony. This is from Jean. She writes, I was in the room where the Vermeer was the day before the heist. I had spent a long time looking at that and also the Rembrandt. I heard the guard say closing time a little before 5. As I started to walk out of the room, I had a powerful sensation, almost a voice in my head that said, look at the Vermeer, look at the Vermeer.
Oh, that gives me just...
Yeah. And by, 2 o'clock the next morning,
it was gone.
We're joined right now from Washington, D.C. by Robert Whitman, former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He spent 20 years with the FBI, recovered $250 million worth of stolen art and cultural property. He now runs the art recovery and protection firm Robert Whitman, Inc. His forthcoming book is Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. Robert Whitman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Do you think these works, some, all, the most precious of these works, will be seen again, Robert Whitman?
Well, I certainly hope so. It would be a true tragedy if these pieces were not recovered at some point, if they didn't come back and be back on the walls of the Gardner Museum.
20 years is a long time. A lot of resources have been put toward tracking these down, including FBI resources. Why do you think they have not been found?
Well, you know, it's a strange thing. What we've found, you know, in these investigations is that if pieces are not recovered within a shorter period of time, say 1 to 5 years, then oftentimes they take a generation to come back. I had many cases involving pieces. I remember one case back in 2001 involving 5 Norman Rockwell paintings that were stolen, and they were stolen in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And literally, they took a whole generation to come back to the, to collectors because people die. You know, people die. They move on.
They get left in attics. You're saying they sort of get left behind and emerge
exactly
when the criminals, the thieves, are themselves maybe not in the picture.
Exactly, and the problem is, you know, art thieves find that, you know, many times the stealing of the art is much easier than the actual selling. The true art in an art heist is not stealing, it's selling it.
Well, where would you go with a Vermeer? Vermeer only painted, what is it, Anne? 33 paintings in his life. I mean, this is an incredibly valuable, some have said $300 million painting. Where would you go with that if you wanted to try and make some gain from it, Robert Whitman?
Well, I can't tell you, I don't know. We didn't recover the Vermeer at this point or the mm-hmm. Rembrandts. It's an open case. The FBI is very much involved in it. It's very important, I know, to the FBI in Boston.
But is there a market for paintings like that? Is there anywhere to take them to gain any of the portion of that hypothetical value?
Well, at this point, you know, from experience, what we find is usually about these things come up onto the market for about 10% of value or less.
And who would buy them or trade for them?
Well, you know, that's the point. Generally speaking, it's if they're not recovered by insurance companies, many times they're recovered by law enforcement or acting undercover as a buyer.
You say it might take a generation, or it often does, for them to come back. Does that mean they show up in a flea market somewhere?
Could be, or it could be that they show up on sale and auction, where you know, a family member at some point decides to try to put it up for sale, or becomes shown to a dealer.
But wouldn't they be recognized immediately? I mean, the Sea of Galilee painting by Rembrandt is so recognizable. The concert is one of so few Vermeers. Wouldn't they be identified right away?
Oh, absolutely. I believe the concert's the only Vermeer at this point that's missing.
That's right.
Be recognized. In the world, that's correct. So, you know, these pieces, if they come back to the market at any time, they will be recognized and recovered. And that's what happens with the very high-profile, high-value art that's stolen.
Let's get a call from Sten in Belmont, Massachusetts. Sten, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm remembering a documentary made, I think, 5 years ago called Stolen. And there was a segment in it that made a argument involving the IRA.
Around these paintings, Sten, from the Gardner?
Mm-hmm. Possible involvement. I guess at the same time there was a Dublin thief, Martin Cahill, who made a similar art theft.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have any opinions on that.
Anthony, please.
Sure. I've looked extensively into it. First of all, the art theft that Sten refers to from Ireland. Mm-hmm. And yes, there was a Vermeer stolen, but the MO couldn't be more different. It was very violent. It was very quick. Guns drawn, people hit with the guns. Just a total different
scenario.
None of
the apologizing for tight handcuffs like you saw in the basement of the Gardner.
None at all. And I know the film that Sten speaking of as well, the movie Stolen, and it does mention the IRA, but it mentions a whole host of different theories. I personally have never seen anything that connects our theft to any type of IRA involvement. That doesn't mean they were not involved, but I've just never seen anything credible that leads us down that road.
Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. And Robert, Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a couple of comments. One thing I think we need to realize is that all the information on these stolen pictures, you can't reveal on the radio. Secondly, I've been a nurse practitioner for 33 years, and I have literally hundreds of secrets in my mind. And
what kind of practitioner did you say you've been, Robert?
Oh, I've been a nurse practitioner.
Uh-huh, okay.
Pediatric, family, and psychiatric, and I have a lot of secrets in my mind. And once it gets to a second person, it gets very difficult to maintain a secret, and for what I'm hearing, three people have. And that brings me to the point of, is $5 million enough? It's risky business turning in $500 million. And these guys, I mean, why bother to cut the picture out of the frame? Just take the frames.
Because they're big. You've got to picture these. These are some of the big Rembrandts, five, six feet, nearly five by four in length. But it's interesting what you raise, Robert, and this issue of secrets. I mean, it is hard to keep secrets.
Yes. Well, actually, there's a tile in Isabella Stewart Gardner's bathroom that says in French, a secret of one is a secret with God, a secret with two is a secret with all.
And yet 20 years, and whoever knows or knew hasn't told anyone in a way that it's come to the surface.
Because I think they're afraid, and I think that there has been a lot of violence associated with people involved in this case.
Is that right? Like what? Not so much in the museum. Where's the violence?
Well, if you map out all of the different leads and suspects and the people they're connected to, it almost has that that tone of when you look at the Kennedy assassination, the inordinate number of unnatural deaths associated with it. But that's not to say that these deaths resulted because of the Gardner.
But once you're into that criminal underground, that's a rough world.
The majority of the times that a name comes up, the person is dead.
Yes, Robert.
I could speak to the amount of the reward.
Yes, please.
Just to give you an example, we did a case in 2005 in Copenhagen involving a $35 million painting, and the thieves wanted $250,000 for it. Mm-hmm. That was the reward offered.
So does $5 million sound like a reasonable reward for $500 million worth of art, potentially?
I think $5 million sounds like a reasonable reward for anything.
Thank you, Bob. That's the largest. We should add that that's the largest private reward ever offered in the world for anything.
Absolutely.
Anthony, you've described this as the largest property theft ever in the world.
Largest theft of anything anywhere in recorded history.
At least by dollar value. Robert, mm-hmm. You were saying?
I was going to say the reward at that amount, I think, is enough to bring out anyone who would have an interest in collecting it or producing that kind of information. Mm-hmm. As I say, $35 million Rembrandt mm-hmm. for $250,000, that's not uncommon. That's a lot of that's what we run into.
Our Buffalo caller asks about details that might not be revealed, and we've got a call from a caller from Los Angeles on a related front, Saad in California. You're on the air, Saad.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
81 minutes is a very long time.
Yes.
No DNA evidence at all, not a hair, not a drop of blood, not a sneeze, not a cell there to give us some clues or fingerprints?
That's a great question. Remember that this crime occurred in 1990, so the evidence collection techniques would be slightly different than they are now. So perhaps when the evidence was collected, it wasn't collected in the manner that perhaps anyone would think this stuff would be missing for 20 years.
You say perhaps, but you must know. I mean, whether they're fingerprints or not, there were DNA evidence or not.
There were fingerprints taken, mm-hmm. But there are no matches. It points they probably mm-hmm. wore some type of glove.
Okay, and was there any DNA evidence that was taken? Could it still be there, a bit of flesh under the sharp edge of one of those gilt frames?
It could be, but I would add also that this is a public institution, so in the last 20 years, many people have passed through it. There would be an enormous amount of elimination work that would have to be done before you could get something of value. Mm.
Terry in Norfolk, Virginia. Terry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I've been a fine arts appraiser for the last 30 years, and I've appraised both in the United States and in Europe and the Middle East. I see an awful lot of suspect customers for fine art in the Middle East. And they buy things without really having any provenance on them from mm-hmm. time to time. Mm-hmm. They buy things because they have lots and lots and lots of money to spare.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if these paintings are somewhere in the Middle East being hoarded in Dubai or somewhere of that sort.
Terry, let us pick it up. Robert Whitman, you've got a book coming out, Priceless. As I understand, mm-hmm. you told our producers that in that book, you say, it comes out not until summer, but you say you know where the Gardner heist is, where the paintings are. Are they in the Middle East? If not, where?
Well, I have my opinions, Tom. I mean, I've worked the case for almost 2 years at the end of my career, as well as having been involved in it throughout, occasionally throughout the career, working with the Boston agents.
So let's hear
I do
it.
Have my own opinions on
let's
it.
Let's hear
and,
it.
And they'll be out when the book comes out.
Well, that's just around the corner. Give us some sense. What continent? The Middle East, Terry asks.
As I said, we will definitely put that out when the book comes out.
But you think you know where they are?
I have an opinion, yes.
Is it kosher? Is it legal for you not to share it if you've got it? I mean, the museum kind of wants these paintings back.
Well, I'll be happy to discuss it with them after the show.
I'll give you a call, Bob.
Okay, Dan.
So when you say you think you know where they are, like within a country, within a state, within a city, within a particular address?
I would say within a country, but again, it's an opinion that I have. All right, as the senior investigator for the National Art Crime Team, having worked these cases for 20 years, and a lot of this that we've talked about today is very interesting because, you know, when we talk about insider theft, which is 87% of all museum theft is insider theft.
Mm-hmm.
There's someone involved from within the museum or the collector or expert community. And a lot of these things that we talked about today, you know, that points towards some type of person who has some knowledge.
So, I mean, but this is a headline. When the former, head of the FBI's National Art Crime Team says he knows where the artwork of the biggest art heist in history is, that's news.
Absolutely.
So
it's my opinion. That's
correct. So, Anthony, do you believe it? He knows. You don't?
I don't know where it is right now. Is that
he says
question?
He does.
I have a world of respect for Bob's experience. I think I'm sure he has a theory. I'd be shocked, actually, if Bob didn't have a theory as to where the art is. And I'm looking forward to seeing the book. I think, and Bob, jump in, correct me if I'm
sure.
wrong, but I think if Bob had an address where the stuff was right now, he definitely would have told us and we'd recover it. So I think we're talking more about a theory as to who may have had it at a certain point or where it could or could have been recently. But in terms of where is the art today, I don't think, and again, Bob, jump in, but I don't think that's what we're talking about here.
Bob, could you drive out and pick it up if you wanted to, Bob?
I'd love to if I could. You know, one thing I would add about that, during the 20 years that I did these cases, I wasn't always focused on who actually did the robberies or did the thefts, because after a certain amount of time, you know, art moves, everything moves. I always was focused on recovery. Okay, so I can't sit here and give you an opinion of who stole them. I don't know. I really don't. But, you know, I'm more focused than always was on getting the paintings back. So that meant finding and locating them to begin with.
Boy.
And then working the case to try to recover them.
Watch this space. One more caller, Pat, Northport, Florida. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is, why deprive the viewing public of the images? Why not hang good copies along with a plaque stating they were stolen and who to contact and the reward?
Pat, thanks. Anne Hawley, there's the pragmatic voice of the American Museum
yes.
goer.
Well, actually, we have reproductions that we are willing to give out to people who ask to see them, but to hang reproductions on the wall along with all the other original works that are there would really be wrong, and it would lead many viewers who don't spend a lot of time looking to think that they were the real thing, and they aren't.
There's no substitute,
no.
I guess, in the end. And in the company, I have to say, Pat, if you could stand there and see all the wonderful original oil paintings, I guess I share that view, mm-hmm. that to have reproductions, it would be glaring. But certainly people want to see them. By the way, you can see the full gallery of all the stolen artworks, all 13 pieces, at our website, onpointradio.org. So many people over the years have worked on this, put their shoulder to this. Senator Ted Kennedy,
yes,
before he died.
Senator Ted Kennedy was involved from the day it happened. He was the first public official on the phone to help us. He, of course, is a painter himself, and he took enormous steps to help us on this investigation. He was immediately contacted the FBI. He continued to insist that it needed to be a high priority case, which with so many competing demands, it was hard to get that through. But the thing that he did that remains is he sponsored legislation soon thereafter that makes it a federal crime to steal art from any public institution. And before that legislation went through, it was not. And so prosecution was not what it is today. And I think it's a deterrent.
You're not standing still. The museum is expanding.
That's correct. We're building a new building.
Looking back, but also looking ahead. Anthony, how many months? How many years? A generation, as Bob says?
Until we find them?
Yeah.
I think it'll be sooner than most people think.
Sooner than most people think. Remember, you heard it here. I want to give a special thanks this hour to Jesse Costa, who produced the video of our visit to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum yesterday. You can see it at the website, onpointradio.org. Robert Whitman, formerly with the FBI, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. I hope recovery is imminent.
We all hope that. Ann Hawley, director of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, thank you very
thank
much
you,
for
Tom.
Being here. And Anthony Morey, director of security there, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your calls and being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.